Reconstruction of the Social Order. Encyclical Pope Pius XI. To our venerable brethren, the patriarchs, primates, archbishops, bishops, and other ordinaries in peace and communion with the Holy See, and likewise to all the faithful of the Catholic world. Venerable brethren and beloved children, health and apostolic benediction. 40 years have passed since Leo XLLL's peerless encyclical on the condition of workers first saw the light, and the whole Catholic world, filled with grateful recollection, is undertaking to commemorate it with befitting solemnity. 2. Other encyclicals of our predecessor had in a way prepared the path for that outstanding document and proof of pastoral care, namely, those on the family and the holy sacrament of matrimony as the source of human society, 1. On the origin of civil authority, 2. And its proper relations with the Church, 3. On the chief duties of Christian citizens, 4. Against the tenets of socialism, 5. Against false teachings on human liberty, 6. And others of the same nature, fully expressing the mind of Leo XLLL. Yet the encyclical on the condition of workers, compared with the rest, had a special distinction, that at time when it was most opportune and actually necessary to do so, it laid down for all mankind the surest rules to solve aright that difficult problem of human relations called the social question. 3. For toward the close of the 19th century, the new kind of economic life that had arisen, and the new developments of industry, had gone to the point in most countries that human society was clearly becoming divided more and more into two classes. One class, very small in number, was enjoying almost all the advantages which modern inventions so abundantly provided; the other, embracing the huge multitude of working people, oppressed by wretched poverty, was vainly seeking escape from the straits wherein it stood. 4. Quite agreeable, of course, was this state of things to those who thought it in their abundant riches the result of inevitable economic loss, and accordingly, as if it were for charity, to veil the violation of justice which lawmakers not only tolerated, but at times sanctioned, wanted the whole care of supporting the poor committed to charity alone. The workers, on the other hand, crushed by their hard lot, were barely entering it, and were refusing longer to bend their necks beneath so galling a yoke, and some of them, carried away by the heat of evil counsel, were seeking the overturn of everything, while others, whom Christian training restrained from such evil designs, stood firm in the judgment that much in this had to be wholly and speedily changed. 5. The same feeling those many Catholics, both priests and laymen, shared, whom a truly wonderful charity had long spurred on to relieve the unmerited poverty of the non-owning workers, and who could in no way convince themselves that so enormous and unjust an inequality in the distribution of this world's goods truly conforms to the designs of the all-wise Creator. 6. Those men were without question sincerely seeking an immediate remedy for this lamentable disorganization of states and a secure safeguard against worse dangers. Yet such is the weakness of even the best of human minds, that, now rejected as dangerous innovators, now hindered in the good work by their very associates advocating other courses of action, and uncertain in the face of various opinions, they were at a loss which way to turn. 7. In such a sharp conflict of mind, therefore, while the question at issue was being argued this way and that, nor always with calmness, all eyes as often before turned to the chair of Peter, to that sacred depository of all truth whence words of salvation pour forth to all the world, and to the feet of Christ's vicar on earth were flocking in unaccustomed numbers, men well versed in social questions, employers, and workers themselves, begging him with one voice to point out, finally, the safe road to them. 8. The wise pontiff long weighed all this in his mind before God. He summoned the most experienced and learned to counsel. He pondered the issues carefully, and from every angle. At last, admonished by the consciousness of his apostolic office, 7, lest silence on his part might be regarded as failure in his duty, 8, he decided, in virtue of the divine teaching office entrusted to him, to address not only the whole Church of Christ, but all mankind. 9. Therefore, on the 15th day of May, 1891, that long-awaited voice thundered forth, neither daunted by the arduousness of the problem, nor weakened by age, but with vigorous energy. It taught the whole human family to strike out in the social question upon new paths. 10. Do you know, venerable brethren and beloved children, and understand full well the wonderful teaching which has made the encyclical, on the condition of workers, illustrious forever, the supreme pastor in this letter, grieving that so large a portion of mankind should live undeservedly in miserable and wretched conditions, 9, took it upon himself with great courage to defend the cause of the workers, whom the present age had handed over, each alone and defenseless, to the inhumanity of employers and the unbridled greed of competitors. 10. He sought no help from either liberalism or socialism, for the one had proved that it was utterly unable to solve the social problem aright, and the other, proposing a remedy far worse than the evil itself, would have plunged human society into great dangers. 11. Since a problem was being treated, for which no satisfactory solution is found, unless religion and the Church have been called upon to aid, 11, the Pope, clearly exercising his right and correctly holding that the guardianship of religion and the stewardship over those things that are closely bound up with it had been entrusted especially to him, and relying solely upon the unchangeable principles drawn from the treasury of right reason and divine revelation, confidently, and as one having authority, 12, declared and proclaimed the rights and duties within which the rich and the proletariat, those who furnish material things, and those who furnish work, ought to be restricted in relation to each other, 13, and what the Church, heads of states, and the people themselves directly concerned ought to do. 12. The apostolic voice did not thunder forth in vain. On the contrary, not only did the obedient children of the Church hearken to it with marveling admiration, and hail it with the greatest applause, but many also who were wandering far from the truth, from the unity of the faith, and nearly all who since then either in private study, or in enacting legislation have concerned themselves with the social and economic question. 13. Feeling themselves vindicated and defended by the supreme authority on earth, Christian workers received this encyclical with special joy. So, too, did all those noble-hearted men who, long solicitous for the improvement of the condition of the workers, had up to that time encountered almost nothing but indifference from many, and even rankling suspicion, if not open hostility, from some, rightly. Therefore, have all these groups constantly held the apostolic encyclical, from that time in such high honor, that to signify their gratitude they are wont, in various places, and in various ways, to commemorate it every year. 14. However, in spite of such great agreement, there were some who were not a little disturbed, and so it happened that the teaching of Leo XLLL, so noble and lofty and so utterly new to worldly ears, was held suspect by some, even among Catholics, and to certain ones it even gave offense, for it boldly attacked and overturned the idols of liberalism, ignored long-standing prejudices, and was in advance of its time beyond all expectation, so that the slow of heart disdained to study this new social philosophy, and the timid feared to scale so lofty a height. There were some also who stood, indeed, in awe at its splendor, but regarded it as a kind of imaginary ideal of perfection more desirable than attainable. 15. Venerable brethren and beloved children, as all everywhere, and especially Catholic workers, who are pouring from all sides into this holy city, are celebrating with such enthusiasm the solemn commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the encyclical on the condition of workers, we deem it fitting on this occasion to recall the great benefits this encyclical has brought to the Catholic Church and to all human society. To defend the illustrious Master's doctrine on the social and economic question against certain doubts, and to develop it more fully as to some points, and lastly, summoning to court the contemporary economic regime and passing judgment on socialism, to lay bare the root of the existing social confusion, and at the same time point the only way to sound restoration, namely, the Christian reform of morals, all these matters which we undertake to treat will fall under three main headings, and this entire encyclical will be devoted to their development. 16. To begin with the topic which we have proposed first to discuss, we cannot refrain, following the counsel of St. Ambrose 14, who says that no duty is more important than that of returning thanks, from offering our fullest gratitude to Almighty God for the immense benefits that have come through Leo's encyclical to the Church and to human society, if indeed we should wish to review these benefits even cursorily. Almost the whole history of the social question during the last 40 years would have to be recalled to mind. These benefits can be reduced conveniently, however, to three main points, corresponding to the three kinds of help which our predecessor ardently desired for the accomplishment of his great work of restoration. 17. In the first place, Leo himself clearly stated what ought to be expected from the Church. 15. Manifestly, it is the Church which draws from the Gospel the teachings through which the struggle can be composed entirely, or, after its bitterness is removed, can certainly become more tempered. It is the Church, again, that strives not only to instruct the mind, but to regulate by her precepts the life and morals of individuals, and that ameliorates the condition of the workers through her numerous and beneficent institutions. 18. The Church did not let these rich fountains liquiescent in her bosom, but from them drew copiously for the common good of the longed-for peace. Leo himself and his successors, showing paternal charity and pastoral constancy always, in defense especially of the poor and the weak, 16, proclaimed and urged without ceasing again and again by voice and pen the teaching on the social and economic question which on the condition of workers presented, and adapted it fittingly to the needs of time and of circumstance, and many bishops have done the same, who in their continual and able interpretation of the same teaching have illustrated it with commentaries, and in accordance with the mind and instructions of the Holy See provided for its application to the conditions and institutions of diverse regions. 17. 19. It is not surprising, therefore, that many scholars, both priests and laymen, led especially by the desire that the unchanged and unchangeable teaching of the Church should meet new demands and needs more effectively, have zealously undertaken to develop, with the Church as their guide and teacher, a social and economic science in accord with the conditions of our time. 20. And so, with Leo's encyclical pointing the way and furnishing the light, a true Catholic social science has arisen, which is daily fostered and enriched by the tireless efforts of those chosen men, whom we have termed auxiliaries of the Church. They do not, indeed, allow their science to lie hidden behind learned walls, as the useful and well-attended courses instituted in Catholic universities, colleges, and seminaries, the social congresses and weeks that are held at frequent intervals with most successful results, the study groups that are promoted, and finally the timely and sound publications that are disseminated everywhere, and in every possible way, clearly show these men bring their science out into the full light and stress of life. 21. Nor is the benefit that has poured forth from Leo's encyclical confined within these bounds, for the teaching which on the condition of workers contains has gradually and imperceptibly worked its way into the minds of those outside Catholic unity who do not recognize the authority of the Church. Catholic principles on the social question have, as a result, passed little by little into the patrimony of all human society, and we rejoice that the eternal truths which our predecessor, of glorious memory, proclaimed so impressively have been frequently invoked and defended not only in non-Catholic books and journals, but in legislative halls, also courts of justice. 22. Furthermore, after the terrible war, when the statesmen of the leading nations were attempting to restore peace on the basis of a thorough reform of social conditions, did not they, among the norms agreed upon to regulate in accordance with justice and equity the labor of the workers, give sanction to many points that so remarkably coincide with Leo's principles and instructions as to seem consciously taken therefrom? The encyclical on the condition of workers, without question, has become a memorable document, and rightly to it may be applied the words of Esaias, "He shall set up a standard to the nations." 18. 23. Meanwhile, as Leo's teachings were being widely diffused in the minds of men, with learned investigations leading the way, they have come to be put into practice. In the first place, zealous efforts have been made, with active goodwill, to lift up that class which on account of the modern expansion of industry had increased to enormous numbers, but not yet had obtained its rightful place or rank in human society, and was, for that reason, all but neglected and despised. The workers, we mean, to whose improvement, to the great advantage of souls, the diocesan and regular clergy, though burdened with other pastoral duties, have under the leadership of the bishops devoted themselves. This constant work, undertaken to fill the workers' souls with the Christian spirit, helped much also to make them conscious of their true dignity, and render them capable, by placing clearly before them the rights and duties of their class, of legitimately and happily advancing, and even of becoming leaders of their fellows. 24. From that time on, fuller means of livelihood have been more securely obtained, for not only did works of beneficence and charity begin to multiply at the urging of the pontiff, but there have also been established everywhere new and continuously expanding organizations in which workers, draftsmen, farmers, and employees of every kind, with the counsel of the Church, and frequently under the leadership of her priests, give and receive mutual help and support. 25. With regard to civil authority, Leo XLLL, boldly breaking through the confines imposed by liberalism, fearlessly taught that government must not be thought a mere guardian of law and of good order, but rather must put forth every effort so that, through the entire scheme of laws and institutions, both public and individual well-being may develop spontaneously out of the very structure and administration of the state. 19. Just freedom of action must, of course, be left both to individual citizens and to families, yet only on condition that the common good be preserved, and wrong to any individual be abolished. The function of the rulers of the state, moreover, is to watch over the community and its parts. But in protecting private individuals and their rights, chief consideration ought to be given to the weak and the poor. For the nation, as it were, of the rich is guarded by its own defenses, and is in less need of governmental protection, whereas the suffering multitude, without the means to protect itself, relies especially on the protection of the state. Wherefore, since wage workers are numbered among the great mass of the needy, the state must include them under its special care and foresight. 20. 26. We, of course, do not deny that even before the encyclic Lovelio, some rulers of peoples have provided for certain of the more urgent needs of the workers, and curbed more flagrant acts of injustice inflicted upon them. But after the apostolic voice had sounded from the chair of Peter, throughout the world, rulers of nations, more fully alive at last to their duty, devoted their minds and attention to the task of promoting a more comprehensive and fruitful social policy. 27. And while the principles of liberalism were tottering, which had long prevented effective action by those governing the state, the encyclical on the condition of workers in truth impelled peoples themselves to promote a social policy on truer grounds, and with greater intensity, and so strongly encouraged good Catholics to furnish valuable help to heads of states in this field, that they often stood forth as illustrious champions of this new policy even in legislatures. Sacred ministers of the Church, thoroughly imbued with Leo's teaching, have, in fact, often proposed to the votes of the people's representatives the very social legislation that has been enacted in recent years, and have resolutely demanded and promoted its enforcement. 28. A new branch of law, wholly unknown to the earlier time, has arisen from this continuous and unwearied labor to protect vigorously the sacred rights of the workers that flow from their dignity as men and as Christians. These laws undertake the protection of life, health, strength, family, homes, workshops, wages, and labor hazards, in fine, everything which pertains to the condition of wage workers, with special concern for women and children. Even though these laws do not conform exactly everywhere, and in all respects to Leo's recommendations, still it is undeniable that much in them savors of the encyclical, on the condition of workers, to which great credit must be given for whatever improvement has been achieved in the workers' condition. 29. Finally, the wise pontiff showed that employers and workers themselves can accomplish much in this matter, manifestly through those institutions by the help of which the poor are opportunely assisted, and the two classes of society are brought closer to each other. 21. First place among these institutions, he declares, must be assigned to associations that embrace either workers alone or workers and employers together. He goes into considerable detail in explaining and commending these associations, and expounds with a truly wonderful wisdom their nature, purpose, timeliness, rights, duties, and regulations. 30. These teachings were issued indeed most opportunely, for at that time in many nations those at the helm of state, plainly imbued with liberalism, were showing little favor to workers' associations of this type, nay, rather they openly opposed them, and while going out of their way to recognize similar organizations of other classes and show favor to them, they were with criminal injustice denying the natural right to form associations to those who needed it most to defend themselves from ill treatment at the hands of the powerful. There were even some Catholics who looked askance at the efforts of workers to form associations of this type, as if they smacked of a socialistic or revolutionary spirit. 31. The rules, therefore, which Leo XIII issued in virtue of his authority, deserve the greatest praise, in that they have been able to break down this hostility, and dispel these suspicions, but they have even a higher claim to distinction in that they encouraged Christian workers to found mutual associations according to their various occupations, taught them how to do so, and resolutely confirmed in the path of duty a goodly number of those whom socialist organizations strongly attracted by claiming to be the sole defenders and champions of the lowly and oppressed. 32. With respect to the founding of these societies, the encyclical on the condition of workers most fittingly declared that workers' associations ought to be so constituted and so governed as to furnish the most suitable and most convenient means to obtain the object proposed, which consists in this, that the individual members of the association secure, so far as is possible, an increase in the goods of body, of soul, and of property. Yet it is clear that moral and religious perfection ought to be regarded as their principal goal, and that their social organization, as such, ought above all to be directed completely by this goal. 22.4. When the regulations of associations are founded upon religion, the way is easy toward establishing the mutual relations of the members, so that peaceful living together and prosperity will result. 23.33. To the founding of these associations the clergy, and many of the laity, devoted themselves everywhere with truly praiseworthy zeal, eager to bring Leo's program to full realization. Thus associations of this kind have molded truly Christian workers, who, in combining harmoniously the diligent practice of their occupation with the salutary precepts of religion, protect effectively and resolutely their own temporal interests and rights, keeping a due respect for justice and a genuine desire to work together with other classes of society for the Christian renewal of all social life. 34. These counsels and instructions of Leo XIII were put into effect differently in different places according to varied local conditions. In some places one and the same association undertook to obtain all the ends laid down by the pontiff, in others, because circumstances suggested or required it, a division of work developed, and separate associations were formed. Of these, some devoted themselves to the defense of the rights and legitimate interests of their members in the labor market, others took over the work of providing mutual economic aid. Finally, still others gave all their attention to the fulfillment of religious and moral duties and other obligations of like nature. 35. This second method has especially been adopted where either the laws of a country, or certain special economic institutions, or that deplorable dissension of minds and hearts so widespread in contemporary society, and an urgent necessity of combating with united purpose and strength the mass ranks of revolutionarists, have prevented Catholics from founding purely Catholic labor unions. Under these conditions, Catholics seem almost forced to join secular labor unions. These unions, however, should always profess justice and equity, and give Catholic members full freedom to care for their own conscience and obey the laws of the Church. It is clearly the office of bishops, when they know that these associations are on account of circumstances necessary and are not dangerous to religion, to approve of Catholic workers joining them, keeping before their eyes, however, the principles and precautions laid down by our predecessor, Pius X of holy memory. 24. Among these precautions the first and chief is this: side by side with these unions there should always be associations zealously engaged in imbuing and forming their members in the teaching of religion and morality, so that they in turn may be able to permeate the unions with that good spirit which should direct them in all their activity, As a result, the religious associations will bear good fruit even beyond the circle of their own membership. 36. To the encyclic Love Leo, therefore, must be given this credit, that these associations of workers have so flourished everywhere that while, alas, still surpassed in numbers by socialist and communist organizations, they already embrace a vast multitude of workers, and are able, within the confines of each nation as well as in wider assemblies, to maintain vigorously the rights and legitimate demands of Catholic workers, and insist also on the salutary Christian principles of society. 37. Leo's learned treatment and vigorous defense of the natural right to form associations began, furthermore, to find ready application to other associations also, and not alone to those of the workers. Hence no small part of the credit must, it seems, be given to this same encyclic Love Leo, for the fact that among farmers and others of the middle class most useful associations of this kind are seen flourishing to a notable degree, and increasing day by day, as well as other institutions of a similar nature, in which spiritual development and economic benefit are happily combined. 38. But if this cannot be said of organizations which our same predecessor intensely desired established among employers and managers of industry, and we certainly regret that they are so few, the condition is not wholly due to the will of men, but to far graver difficulties that hinder associations of this kind which we know well and estimate at their full value. There is, however, strong hope that these obstacles also will be removed soon, and even now we greet with the deepest joy of our soul certain by no means insignificant attempts in this direction, the rich fruits of which promise a still richer harvest in the future. 25. 39. All these benefits of Leo's encyclical, venerable brethren and beloved children, which we have outlined rather than fully described, are so numerous, and of such import, as to show plainly that this immortal document does not exhibit a merely fanciful, even if beautiful, ideal of human society. Rather did our predecessor draw from the gospel, and, therefore, from an ever-living and life-giving fountain, teachings capable of greatly mitigating, if not immediately terminating, that deadly internal struggle which is rending the family of mankind, the rich fruits which the Church of Christ and the whole human race have, by God's favor, reaped therefrom unto salvation prove that some of this good seed, so lavishly sown 40 years ago, fell on good ground. On the basis of the long period of experience, it cannot be rash to say that Leo's encyclical has proved itself the Magna Charta upon which all Christian activity in the social field ought to be based, as on a foundation, and those who would seem to hold in little esteem this papal encyclical and its commemoration either blaspheme what they know not, or understand nothing of what they are only superficially acquainted with, or if they do understand, convict themselves formally of injustice and ingratitude. 40. Yet since in the course of these same years, certain doubts have arisen concerning either the correct meaning of some parts of Leo's encyclical or conclusions to be deduced therefrom, which doubts in turn have even among Catholics given rise to controversies that are not always peaceful, and since, furthermore, new needs and changed conditions of our age have made necessary a more precise application of Leo's teaching, or even certain additions thereto, we most gladly seize this fitting occasion. In accord with our apostolic office, through which we are debtors to all, 26, to answer, so far as in us lies, these doubts and these demands of the present day. 41. Yet before proceeding to explain these matters, That principle which Leo XIII so clearly established must be laid down at the outset here, namely, that there resides in us the right and duty to pronounce with supreme authority upon social and economic matters. 27. Certainly the Church was not given the commission to guide men to an only fleeting and perishable happiness, but to that which is eternal. Indeed, the Church holds that it is unlawful for her to mix without cause in these temporal concerns. 28. However, she can in no wise renounce the duty God entrusted to her to interpose her authority, not of course in matters of technique, for which she is neither suitably equipped nor endowed by office, but in all things that are connected with the moral law. For as to these, the deposit of truth that God committed to us, and the grave duty of disseminating and interpreting the whole moral law, and of urging it in season and out of season, bring under and subject to our supreme jurisdiction not only social order, but economic activities themselves. 42. Even though economics and moral science employs each its own principles in its own sphere, it is, nevertheless, an error to say that the economic and moral orders are so distinct from and alien to each other that the former depends in no way on the latter. Certainly the laws of economics, as they are termed, being based on the very nature of material things, and on the capacities of the human body and mind, determine the limits of what productive human effort cannot, and of what it can attain in the economic field, and by what means. Yet it is reason itself that clearly shows, on the basis of the individual and social nature of things, and of men, the purpose which God ordained for all economic life. 43. But it is only the moral law which, just as it commands us to seek our supreme and last end, in the whole scheme of our activity, so likewise commands us to seek directly in each kind of activity those purposes which we know that nature, or rather God the author of nature, established for that kind of action, and in orderly relationship, to subordinate such immediate purpose to our supreme and last end. If we faithfully observe this law, then it will follow that the particular purposes, both individual and social, that are sought in the economic field will fall in their proper place in the universal order of purposes, and we, in ascending through them, as it were by steps, shall attain the final end of all things, that is God, to Himself, and to us, the supreme and inexhaustible good. 44. But to come down to particular points, we shall begin with ownership, or the right of property. Venerable brethren and beloved children, do you know that our predecessor, of happy memory, strongly defended the right of property against the tenets of the socialists of his time, by showing that its abolition would result, not to the advantage of the working class, but to their extreme harm? Yet since there are some who calumniate the Supreme Pontiff, and the Church herself, as if she had taken, and were still taking the part of the rich against the non-owning workers, certainly no accusation is more unjust than that, and since Catholics are at variance with one another concerning the true and exact mind of Leo, it has seemed best to vindicate this, that is, the Catholic teaching, on this matter from calumnies, and safeguard it from false interpretations. 45. First, then, let it be considered as certain and established that neither Leo, nor those theologians who have taught under the guidance and authority of the Church have ever denied or questioned the twofold character of ownership, called usually individual or social according, as it regards either separate persons or the common good, for they have always unanimously maintained that nature, rather the Creator Himself, has given man the right of private ownership, not only that individuals may be able to provide for themselves and their families, but also that the goods which the Creator destined for the entire family of mankind may through this institution truly serve this purpose. All this can be achieved in no wise except through the maintenance of a certain and definite order. 46. Accordingly, twin rocks of shipwreck must be carefully avoided, for, as one is wrecked upon, or comes close to, what is known as, individualism, by denying or minimizing the social and public character of the right of property, so by rejecting or minimizing the private and individual character of the same right, one inevitably runs into collectivism, or at least closely approaches its tenets. Unless this is kept in mind, one is swept from his course upon the shoals of that moral, juridical, and social modernism which we denounced in the encyclical issued at the beginning of our pontificate. 29. And, in particular, let those realize this who, in their desire for innovation, do not scruple to reproach the Church with infamous calumnies, as if she had allowed to creep into the teachings of her theologians a pagan concept of ownership which must be completely replaced by another that they with amazing ignorance call Christian. 47. In order to place definite limits on the controversies that have arisen over ownership and its inherent duties, there must be first laid down as foundation a principle established by Leo XIII, the right of property is distinct from its use. 30. That justice called commutative commands sacred respect for the division of possessions, and forbids invasion of others' rights through the exceeding of the limits of one's own property. But the duty of owners to use their property only in a right way does not come under this type of justice, but under other virtues, obligations of which cannot be enforced by legal action. 31. Therefore, they are in error who assert that ownership and its right use are limited by the same boundaries, and it is much farther still from the truth to hold that a right to property is destroyed or lost by reason of abuse or non-use. 48. Those, therefore, are doing a work that is truly salutary and worthy of all praise, who, while preserving harmony among themselves and the integrity of the traditional teaching of the Church, seek to define the inner nature of these duties and their limits, whereby either the right of property itself or its use, that is, the exercise of ownership, is circumscribed by the necessities of social living. On the other hand, those who seek to restrict the individual character of ownership to such a degree that in fact they destroy it are mistaken, and in error. 49. It follows from what we have termed the individual, and at the same time social character of ownership, that men must consider in this matter not only their own advantage, but also the common good. To define these duties in detail, when necessity requires, and the natural law has not done so, is the function of those in charge of the state. Therefore, public authority, under the guiding light always of the natural and divine law, can determine more accurately upon consideration of the true requirements of the common good, what is permitted, and what is not permitted to owners in the use of their property. Moreover, Leo XIII wisely taught that God has left the limits of private possessions to be fixed by the industry of men and institutions of peoples. 32. That history proves ownership, like other elements of social life, to be not absolutely unchanging, we once declared, as follows: what divers forms has property had, from that primitive form among rude and savage peoples, which may be observed in some places even in our time, to the form of possession in the patriarchal age, and so further to the various forms under tyranny, we are using the word tyranny in its classical sense, and then through the feudal and monarchical forms down to the various types which are to be found in more recent times. 33. That the state is not permitted to discharge its duty arbitrarily is, however, clear. The natural right itself both of owning goods privately and of passing them on by inheritance ought always to remain intact and inviolate, since this indeed is a right that the state cannot take away, for man is older than the state, 34. And also, domestic living together is prior both in thought, and in fact to uniting into a polity. 35. Wherefore the wise pontiff declared that it is grossly unjust for a state to exhaust private wealth through the weight of imposts and taxes. For since the right of possessing goods privately has been conferred not by man's law, but by nature, public authority cannot abolish it, but can only control its exercise, and bring it into conformity with the common weal. 36. Yet when the state brings private ownership into harmony with the needs of the common good, it does not commit a hostile act against private owners, but rather does them a friendly service, for it thereby effectively prevents the private possession of goods, which the author of nature in his most wise providence ordained for the support of human life, from causing intolerable evils, and thus rushing to its own destruction. It does not destroy private possessions, but safeguards them, and it does not weaken private property rights, but strengthens them. 50. Furthermore, a person's superfluous income, that is, income which he does not need to sustain life fittingly and with dignity, is not left wholly to his own free determination. Rather, the sacred scriptures and the fathers of the church constantly declare in the most explicit language that the rich are bound by a very grave precept to practice almsgiving, beneficence, and munificence. 51. Expending larger income so that opportunity for gainful work may be abundant, provided, however, that this work is applied to producing really useful goods, ought to be considered, as we deduce from the principles of the angelic doctor, 37, an outstanding exemplification of the virtue of munificence, and one particularly suited to the needs of the times. 52. That ownership is originally acquired both by occupancy of a thing not owned by any one, and by labor, or, as is said, by specification, the tradition of all ages as well, as the teaching of our predecessor Leo clearly testifies. For, whatever some idly say to the contrary, no injury is done to any person when a thing is occupied that is available to all, but belongs to no one. However, only that labor which a man performs in his own name, and by virtue of which a new or more increase has been given to a thing, grants him title to these fruits. 53. Far different is the nature of work that is hired out to others, and expended on the property of others. To this indeed especially applies what Leo XIII says is incontestable, namely, that the wealth of nations originates from no other source, and from the labor of workers. 38. For is it not plain that the enormous volume of goods that makes up human wealth is produced by and issues from the hands of the workers, that either toil unaided, or have their efficiency marvelously increased by being equipped with tools or machines? Every one knows, too, that no nation has ever risen out of want and poverty to a better and nobler condition save by the enormous and combined toil of all the people, both those who manage work, and those who carry out directions. But it is no less evident that, had not God the Creator of all things, in keeping with His goodness, first generously bestowed natural riches and resources, the wealth and forces of nature, such supreme efforts would have been idle and vain. Indeed, could never even have begun, for what else is work but to use or exercise the energies of mind and body, on, or through these very things, and in the application of natural resources to human use? The law of nature, or rather God's will promulgated by it, demands that right order be observed. This order consists in this, that each thing have its proper owner. Hence it follows that unless a man is expending labor on his own property, the labor of one person and the property of another must be associated, for neither can produce anything without the other. Leo XIII certainly had this in mind when he wrote, "Neither capital can do without labor, nor labor without capital." 39. Wherefore it is wholly false to ascribe to property alone, or to labor alone, whatever has been obtained through the combined efforts of both, and it is wholly unjust for either, denying the efficacy of the other, to arrogate to itself whatever has been produced. 54. Property, that is, capital, has undoubtedly long been able to appropriate too much to itself. Whatever was produced, whatever returns accrued, capital claimed for itself, hardly leaving to the worker enough to restore and renew his strength. For the doctrine was preached that all accumulation of capital falls by an absolutely insuperable economic law to the rich, and that by the same law the workers are given over and bound to perpetual want, to the scantiest of livelihoods. It is true, indeed, that things have not always, and everywhere, corresponded with this sort of teaching of the so-called Manchesterian liberals, yet it cannot be denied that economic social institutions have moved steadily in that direction, that these false ideas, these erroneous suppositions, have been vigorously assailed, and not by those alone who through them were being deprived of their innate right to obtain better conditions, will surprise no one. 55. And therefore, to the harassed workers there have come, intellectuals, as they are called, setting up in opposition to a fictitious law the equally fictitious moral principle, that all products and profits, save only enough to repair and renew capital, belong by very right to the workers. This error, much more specious than that of certain of the socialists, who hold that whatever serves to produce goods ought to be transferred to the state, or, as they say, socialized, is consequently all the more dangerous, and the more apt to deceive the unwary. It is an alluring poison which many have eagerly drunk whom open socialism had not been able to deceive. 56. Unquestionably, so as not to close against themselves the road to justice and peace, through these false tenets, both parties ought to have been forewarned by the wise words of our predecessor. However the earth may be apportioned among private owners, it does not cease to serve the common interests of all. 40. This same doctrine we ourselves also taught above in declaring that the division of goods which results from private ownership was established by nature itself in order that created things may serve the needs of mankind in fixed and stable order. Lest one wander from the straight path of truth, this is something that must be continually kept in mind. 57. But not every distribution among human beings of property and wealth is of a character to attain either completely, or to a satisfactory degree of perfection the end which God intends. Therefore, the riches that economic social developments constantly increase ought to be so distributed among individual persons and classes, that the common advantage of all, which Leo XIII had praised, will be safeguarded, in other words, that the common good of all society will be kept inviolate. By this law of social justice, one class is forbidden to exclude the other from sharing in the benefits. Hence the class of the wealthy violates this law no less, when, as if free from care on account of its wealth, it thinks it the right order of things for it to get everything, and the worker nothing, than does the non-owning working class, when, anger deeply at outraged justice, and too ready to assert wrongly the one right it is conscious of, it demands for itself everything as if produced by its own hands, and attacks, and seeks to abolish, therefore, all property, and returns or incomes, of whatever kind they are, or whatever the function they perform in human society, that have not been obtained by labor, and for no other reason save that they are of such a nature, and in this connection we must not pass over the unwarranted and unmerited appeal made by some to the apostle, when he said, "If any man will not work, neither let him eat." 41, for the apostle is passing judgment on those who are unwilling to work, although they can, and ought to, and he admonishes us that we ought diligently to use our time and energies of body and mind, and not be a burden to others, when we can provide for ourselves. But the apostle in no wise teaches that labor is the sole title to a living, or an income. 42. 58.